It's not easy being green.
Yep, that's Kermit the Frog, one of the many characters that sprang from the fertile mind of the late Jim Henson. With Sesame Street and The Muppet Show, Henson already had a special place in history. But his creations covered so much more territory. A traveling exhibition of Jim Henson's work opened this weekend at the Smithsonian International Gallery in Washington, D.C. It's called Jim Henson's Fantastic World. I got a private tour with curator Karen Falk. She's also the archivist of the Jim Henson Company.
Well, Jim was an interesting person in that he saved everything. He kept all of his artwork, his designs. He didn't go back to it very often, but he set it aside, figuring at some point somebody might be interested in taking a look at it. So we have a huge group of materials to choose from. It was difficult picking what was going to go in this exhibit.
And it's just as difficult figuring out where to start the tour. Colorful posters, scrawled ideas, and actual Muppets call out from every wall and every corner. But at the very front is perhaps the most famous Henson character of all, the fuzzy green frog himself.
But why wonder? Why wonder?
We couldn't represent Jim Henson and his creative thinking without having Kermit present. This is a Kermit the Frog puppet that Jim performed in the 1970s, and he really exemplifies Jim's role with his collaborators, sort of keeping all the crazies in order, but also causing a lot of the craziness himself. So it's really wonderful to have him represent Jim here in the exhibit.
Let's walk and look at some of the things here.
May I make a suggestion?
Who are you?
I'm LaCroix Dragon.
Yeah, a real dragon.
LaCroix Chow Mein is quick cooked by me in dragon fire.
Tell me where we're going now.
Well, something that a lot of people don't know about Jim Henson is in the, starting in 1957, he did a lot of work in television commercials. And throughout the 60s, he made hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of television commercials, starting with a local coffee company here in Washington, the Wilkins Coffee Company, making these 8-second commercials featuring Wilkins and Wonkins, a character, Wilkins, who was the company spokesman, and Wonkins, who won't drink the coffee. And then you can actually see the commercial on the video monitor here.
With this camera, I shoot pictures of people who don't drink Wilkins coffee.
I'm ready. Shoot.
Anybody else?
A lot of actors get their start in commercials, and something that people don't realize is a lot of Muppets got their start in commercials, too. And my favorite Muppet, Ralph the dog, is here.
Oh.
You may not know this, but I'm really a very sentimental dog.
And Ralph actually got started on a Purina dog chow commercial.
Oh, you're kidding.
I'm not kidding. Jim hired Don Celine, who was a well-known puppet builder, to work with him. Ralph became really the first nationally known Muppet. He was on the Jimmy Dean Show, which is a variety show, for 3 years in the early 60s. And was Jimmy Dean's old hound dog buddy. And he did sales films for IBM. He was the spokesdog for IBM in the 60s and was host of a summer replacement variety show in 67.
Wow.
And then ultimately, of course, people got to know him better as a singer and performer on The Muppet Show. And this particular puppet is from The Muppet Show era. It's not the original Ralph. It was made around 1976.
It's the Ralph I know.
It's the Ralph from The Muppet Show era.
When I think of Ralph, I think of the Muppet movie, the scene where he sings, "You can't live with him, you can't live with him."
That's the best scene because he's singing a duet with Kermit the Frog.
Yep.
And these are Jim's two alter egos, and they are performing together.
What are the two alter egos? What are the characteristics?
Well, I think Jim had a lot of himself in all of the characters he performed. But I think those are the two that really stand out. Kermit, for obvious reasons, in terms of being the leader of the group, and really sort of the idea man, but also concerned with the world and wanting to make the world a better place. I think that was very much Jim. Ralph is the more philosophical, fun, laid-back Jim Henson. Thought about the world, appreciated the world, and that's very much the Ralph side of Jim, I think.
All that he needs, a lassie, a lover and wife, gives you a new leash on life.
Was that a new leash on life?
Oh, yeah. Sorry about that. 2, 3, 4.
Shall we move on?
Sure.
This looks like early Fraggle Rock.
Well, it's Menomina.
It's Menomina.
Are you going to sing
here,
it?
Here, let's do it.
You sing
I'll
it.
Do the Menomina. Manamana.
Do, 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 do.
Manamana. Do, 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 do. Manamana. Do, 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 do. Manamana. Do, 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 do.
They really exemplify the really crazy, fun, silly side of the Muppets.
What's that guy?
He's Manamana.
He's the Manamana. Okay, right. The guy who says that he's got green fur but orange crazy hair, furry, feathery hair, and looks like he's wearing a pair of shades. He's a cool guy.
He is a cool guy, and he's one of a lot of characters that Jim developed in the 1960s for variety show appearances. The Muppets were on the Ed Sullivan Show 25 times.
The youngsters have been sending in loads of mail asking me when we plan to have the Muppets back on our show. Well, I don't know exactly, so here they are now. The Muppets!
So further on, it looks like we're leaving Muppet.
Well, you know, during the 1960s, Jim really had sort of two career tracks going. He was doing his Muppets in commercials and variety shows, but he was also doing a lot of experimentation in film. In 1964, he made a short film called Timepiece, and Timepiece was nominated for an Academy Award for Best Short Film. On the video monitor, we have footage from the film, and then we've put next to the footage his storyboard frames that match the scenes he was shooting. He didn't write a script. There's no dialogue in the movie. It's all sound effects and music that goes with the images.
Let me just describe it a little bit. There's a doctor checking his heartbeat, of the heartbeat of the man. There's sort of an animation of the heartbeat, very interesting.
The man is Jim Henson.
He's tapping his fingers. He looks at the clock. A bird flies into the window. His heart is beating. Again, this animation of his heart beating. His eyes are blinking. He's tapping the book. It just seems like it's a montage almost of interesting, crazy shots.
It's something of a stream of consciousness idea of our struggle to find enough time to do everything. But it's very humorous, even though it's got sort of a serious message. But it's very funny to watch, as well as thought-provoking.
And listeners can check out a little bit of Timepiece on our website, npr.org.
And I think he was at a crossroads at the end of the 1960s. Which direction am I going with my career? Do I really focus on the Muppets? Do I really focus on the experimental film? And I think he might have been leaning toward the experimental film work. But then he got a call about coming to a meeting to talk about a new show called Sesame Street.
Sunny day, sweeping up clouds away.
Let's go in and see this. What is this video here?
At the end of the show, we have a 20-minute sort of a overview of Jim's career, but we wanted to present it in Jim's voice, give him a chance to tell you about his work.
I've always loved this show. I've loved being a part of it from the very beginning, and it was something that during the 70s, I suppose, the whole country felt it was slightly in a depression, you know, and emotional type of depression. And when you were working for the preschool kids, like the fives, four, five, six-year-olds, you can't be depressed about that. I mean, you know, this is such a wonderful age, and it's this wonderful innocence that you're dealing with. So I love doing all of that for all of those years.
It's eerie hearing his voice because, you know, he's been... I remember when he died. It was a blow to culture, and a lot of, especially for those of us who grew up with Sesame Street. And his voice is, you know, modulated into Kermit. It's all these important voices in our young lives. It's kind of touching and sad to hear him.
Well, I think that it's also a celebration of Jim. Jim left us with so many wonderful characters and so many fond memories and experiences, and his characters continue to live on. You can turn on new Sesame Street episodes every year. His company continues to make new programming. So I think that it's really exciting to be able to present him to a new generation of fans, not just the work, which they continue to see on television, but also the man and what he had to say about how we face the world and how we present ourselves in a fun, creative, celebrational way, really.
Karen Falk, the curator of Jim Henson's Fantastic World, thank you very much.
Oh, well, thanks for coming.
Why are there so many songs songs about rainbows and what's on the other side.
The exhibit runs through October here in Washington, then it's off to Atlanta and across the rest of the country.
This summer, we've been receiving communiques from Captain Fatty Goodlander, the editor-at-large of Cruising World magazine. He's continuing to sail his boat, the Wild Card, with his wife across the seas. This weekend, he sent this message in a bottle.
You know, I'm astonished how often people ask me if we anchor at night while on ocean passages. The answer, of course, is no. The ocean is very deep, in places over 30,000 feet deep, about the height that a jetliner flies, which is far, far too deep for a recreational sailboat to anchor in. We just keep sailing all day, all night, occasionally for months in a row, without stop. We don't have to steer. We have a mechanical wind vane to do that, and it steers us flawlessly without any external power source, but we do have to keep a watch out for ships. I am on watch when my wife Carolyn sleeps. At regular intervals, I wake her up, and she is in complete charge of the vessel while I nap. I don't find it boring at all to be on passage. Besides sleeping and keeping a lookout, I do navigation, I keep a log, I maintain the vessel. My wife Carolyn cooks, we read a lot, we make love a lot, we argue, we laugh, we get naked, we shout aloud at God, we sing joyously his praises at the top of our lungs, we act like complete and utter fools in deep ocean, we act like the happy, delirious children that we are. Mother Nature herself entertains us. Clouds, birds, waves, stars, planets, meteors, rainbows, moonbows, lightning. We listen to our shortwave radio, mostly the BBC, but we listen to NPR as we sailed past the U.S. military base on Diego Garcia in the middle of the Indian Ocean. How strange to hear all things considered so far out to sea, like a lost century-old radio signal emerging from the ether. It is hard for me to get my head around the fact that America goes on and on and on as I sail. I don't feel like an American anymore. I don't feel like a Chicagoan or a Southsider or someone born the lying in hospital on the lip of Lake Michigan on Groundhog's Day, February 2nd, 1952. I feel like a sailor. I feel like a seabird. I feel free, utterly, completely, deliciously free. I live in the last place without fences, without rules, without cops, without social restraints of any kind. I am free, free as any man can be, as free as any man ever was, almost continuously. Sure, I have to occasionally stop, touch land, mingle with dirt dwellers and their slick, glad-handing politicians, and of course, the related uniform power thugs, which anxiously encircle them. You know, they don't talk about extortion these days. Nah, it's not PC. They don't talk about strong-arm tactics or intimidation. Nah, we're far too civilized for that. Instead, we call it taxes and universal health care. And my favorite, paying one's fair share. Whenever I hear that phrase, I think of it being uttered by Tony Soprano. No, you know, I'm far happier at sea. The rules are plain. God is strict. You goof up, you die. That's plain enough, isn't it? It's easy for me, a guy like me, to be happy offshore. You soon realize that all the happiness you'll ever need is already inside you. That happiness isn't something you'll ever find, but something that you already have plenty of. That there is no path to happiness, that happiness itself is the path. And thus I sail and sail and sail.
You can track Captain Fatty's progress on the Wild Card and hear more of his essays at our website, npr.org. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Leanne Hansen. This week, an already bad housing market got even worse. Markets tumbled on rumors that the Bush administration would bail out mortgage lenders Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae. Then, on Friday, federal regulators seized IndyMac Bank, one of the nation's largest lenders, because of questions about its viability. The failure of IndyMac is one of the biggest in U.S. history. The bank is now being run by the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, or FDIC. Joining us in the studio is Karen Shaw Petru. She's a managing partner at Federal Financial Analytics, a Washington-based firm that assesses risk in the financial sector. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Briefly remind us, what exactly is the FDIC and what does it do? What's its role?
The FDIC was set up in the early 1930s by the Roosevelt administration so that the nation would never have to go through the kind of bank runs that were a critical and awful part of the Great Depression. It's that sticker you see at every teller window on every bank in the United States, and it means that your insured deposit is covered by an agency of the federal government.
Insured deposit up to a certain point?
Up to $100,000.
What does it mean, then, that the FDIC has taken over this bank?
It means that it will now work through the bank, paying off the insured depositors, figuring out who are the uninsured depositors and the other creditors of the bank, and after it's paid off all of the insured deposits, what's left. And in a what's called a resolution, it will then parcel out the pieces of the bank, trying to make that as the least cost possible resolution to preserve the integrity of the FDIC and minimize potential costs to taxpayers.
Are the uninsured depositors out of luck?
That depends. In some bank failures, there was one in the early 2001, where the FDIC was able to sell off the failed bank for enough money to pay all the uninsured depositors and the creditors and still make a couple dollars for the FDIC. But that's unusual. Usually an uninsured depositor and other creditors will take a hit.
As of March, IndyMac Bank had $32 billion in assets. How deep are the FDIC's pockets? I mean, can it get into trouble if banks keep folding like this?
The FDIC can, and the amount of insured deposits at IndyMac is considerably less than the total amount of the assets in the bank, and the fund is ample, and if it, for any reason, encountered short-term funding problems, the federal government would stand behind it. Banks fund the FDIC. All insured banks pay a premium into the FDIC for the coverage. And if at any point the coverage runs short, the Treasury writes a check and then the banks pay it back.
IndyMac is the fifth bank to close this year. Do you think the American public should be worried that this might be a trend?
We'll have more bank failures. There's no question in my mind that this is going to be a tough year. We've all been lulled into complacency. We've had a lot of good years. A boom brings that out in the banking system, and it makes us all lazy. It means that uninsured depositors get too relaxed and they don't take care. It means that regulators get lazy. We've been through a period of time in which we all sort of thought that, gee, regulation is always wrong and the market is always right, and I think we got a little too careless.
Karen Shaw Petru is a managing partner at Federal Financial Analytics based here in Washington, D.C. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Leanne Hansen. All this month, we're asking the question, who is an American? The city of Philadelphia, where the colonists declared independence, is a good place to find answers, and the answers differ from century to century. Our series began last Sunday when reporter Joel Rose told us about the city in 1708 and the Quakers.
As of 1708, Quakers were easily the largest group in Philadelphia.
Philadelphia, man.
We recently took a train up to Pennsylvania to learn about the Philadelphia of 1808 and to hear the story of a 19th century visionary, Charles Wilson Peel. Born in 1741 on the eastern shore of Maryland, Peel applied the democratic ideals of the new nation to culture. He studied painting with Benjamin West in London and eventually settled in the city of brotherly love.
I'm standing at the corner of 3rd and Lombard Streets in Philadelphia. It's a very busy intersection. On the corner, you can see new condos. There's a school for boys and girls across the street. But this site used to be the home of Charles Peel. Charles Peel is probably best known for his portraits of some of the patriots of the Revolution. But you may not know that he is essentially responsible for the museum system we have in the United States. He began to collect artifacts and display them in his home here at 3rd and Lombard. He eventually moved to a bigger site. And to find out more about him, we'll have to go to an institution that he helped to found, the Pennsylvania Academy of Fine Arts.
I'm David Brigham, the Edna S. Tuttleman Museum Director at the Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts in Philadelphia.
When we met Brigham at the Academy, he escorted us to a gallery upstairs full of Peale's portraits to tell us more about the man.
He was a soldier in the American Revolution and, in fact, managed to meet all of the major generals, including Washington, painted their portraits, set up a painting room here in Philadelphia. In 1786, someone brought to him a bone from Kentucky of a mastodon, and Peale was fascinated by it and put it on display in his painting room and found that it was a greater attraction than all of the paintings. So being a curious person and someone who was brought up in the Enlightenment tradition, established what became the most important and really the first public museum of art and science in America.
David Brigham also says that Peale wanted his museum to be a national university, that it should be available to the learned and the unwise.
This was not going to be an aristocratic nation, and that education would not be reserved for the few. There was a great deal of discussion in the early republic about how we would sustain this new nation that we had created, not only political freedom, but economic freedom. And Peale felt that by understanding nature, by promoting new inventions, that he could encourage that economic independence.
There's a painting of Peale's we wanted to see across town on the second floor of the Philadelphia Museum of Art. So we met up with curator Carol Soltis, an expert on Peale. She walked us over to a portrait of his two sons, Raphael and Titian Ramsey Peale the First. It's called The Staircase Group.
Carol, are you taking us to the Peale's?
Yes.
Great. It looks like Peale is having some fun with us here with this installation because as I walk up to it, it does look like a doorway, and there is a step.
Yes.
But then the painting begins, but it's like that trompe d'oeil feeling where
exactly.
It's one-dimensional, but it looks three-dimensional.
This is another picture that I think is so multi-layered because you have it as a kind of advertisement for the museum. You see Raphael representing art striding up the staircase, and you see Titian Ramsey Peale the First pointing upward, the whole idea of nature and up to nature's God, so a very common thing that you see in all master paintings.
Soltis says Peale was a deist. His museum of natural specimens and man-made objects was to represent God's work, and Peale wanted to educate people about how to continue and nurture that work. He kept the museum open in the evening so working people could see the displays and attend lectures. Anyone was welcome. Anyone who could afford the 25-cent admission, that is. David Brigham says that in many respects, Peale drafted the blueprint for the way museums are run today.
Not only did he create the first museum, but he created the first marketing campaigns, the first solicitations for gifts to his museum. He had certificates that donors received that said, "Of grains of sand are mountains made." So the idea was that this was collective, that this was not only Peale's museum, it was the community's museum, it was the nation's museum, and he really believed that.
Again, Carol Soltis.
For Peale, it was about educating, enlightening, and entertaining. He had to please the public to some degree because he got his money mostly from admissions, so you had to do things like have moving pictures, which he painted these moving pictures with lights behind them, and that was fun. He brought in professors to lecture on different topics, and he had new ethnographic finds. Ultimately, the museum became the repository for the expeditions out west for Lewis and Clark and those coming after, and Jefferson would just sort of send them stuff, you know. It was like, well, there's a place to go with it. You know, there was no Smithsonian, so you send it to Peale.
After Charles Wilson Peale's death at the age of 85 in 1827, the museum was left to his sons. But they were not as successful as their father, and by the 1840s, the Peale Museum had closed. Most of the artifacts were sold. In fact, one of the buyers was the ultimate showman, P.T. Barnum. But according to David Brigham, many of Charles Wilson Peale's 19th century ideas are still fresh today.
He wanted culture not to be difficult and somehow painful, but fun and uplifting and entertaining. And I think that is something that has consistently come down to us into the 21st century. It was described in the 20th century as middlebrow culture. And, you know, we have a highbrow, lowbrow division, but there's an awfully big middlebrow. And I think Peel was an advocate of that middlebrow. PBS, the History Channel, things like that, that you can be educated and learn in a fun way.
David Brigham is the Edna S. Tuttleman Museum Director at the Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts in Philadelphia. He also wrote the book Public Culture in the Early Republic, Peel's Museum and Its Audience. Our thanks also to Carol Soltis from the Philadelphia Museum of Art. In her 5-decades-long career, British jazz vocalist Norma Winston has pioneered, experimented, and collaborated to push her music to the cutting edge. She's developed wordless vocals, written her own lyrics, and covered the classics, always ending up with something new.
Every time we say goodbye, I die a little.
This is Winston's cover of Cole Porter's Every Time We Say Goodbye. The dark atmosphere of this well-known tune was created by the two other musicians in her trio, Italian pianist Glauco Venier and German clarinetist Klaus Gesing. They recently released a new recording on the ECM label. It's called Distances, and Norma Winston joins us from the studios of the BBC Radio Kent in Royal Tunbridge Wells, England. Welcome to the program.
Glad to be here, Leah.
It's a treat to talk to you. I have to say that this is my introduction to you, and I could have sworn by the sound of your voice that you were no older than 30.
Thank you very much.
Do you feel your voice has actually, the evolution of your voice, as you grow older, it seems to be getting younger?
Well, I don't know about younger, but I seem to be able to do more what I want to do with it. You know, maybe I'm not trying so hard also to do difficult things, you know, which I was as a beginner, you know. I eventually got around to really trying to do something about the sound of my voice.
There's no love song finer, but how strange the change from major to
You are known as a modern jazz pioneer, but this recording is also very rooted in tradition. I mean, given the fact that you've chosen to interpret a Cole Porter tune, what kind of effort did you make to balance the past and the present in terms of this recording and your interpretations of this classic?
There was no effort really to do anything. We got together and recorded things that we liked, you know, things we were interested in, some things we had played before, some we hadn't. I know loads and loads of standards because I was brought up with them. You know, my parents loved them. I was brought up with Sinatra, Lena Horne, long before I knew anything about jazz. It was just music. And so I learnt loads of standards. So they're in there. And I love standards. And I mean, I've never said that I am a pioneering singer. This is what everybody else writes, because I kind of got for a little while involved in the free jazz movement, which happened in the late 60s in London.
Your collaborators are indeed younger than you, and actually, I mean, you're pretty hip. You brought them a 1977 tune by Peter Gabriel,
yes.
And there's a reinterpretation of this. It's called Here Comes the Flood.
Stranded starfish have no place to hide, still waiting for the swollen Easter tide.
What inspired you to reinterpret Peter Gabriel's piece?
Well, I'm always on the lookout for songs which touch me in some way, and people had often mentioned Peter Gabriel, and I bought a compilation CD of his, and this happened to be on there, Here Comes the Flood, and it just had a great atmosphere which I felt was right for me, and I thought the other guys would like it, and I played it to them, and they immediately said, oh yeah, we have to do this one.
Lord, here comes the flood. We will say goodbye to flesh and blood.
The
this was such a collaborative effort. I mean, you brought songs to the table. Mm. Vanier brought songs to the table. Gesing brought songs to the table. There's a song, I want to ask you how to pronounce it. It's Giant with a C. It's Italian.
Oh, Chant.
Chant.
Yes. Ah. It's from a poem by Pier Paolo Pasolini, who actually comes from the region where Glauco lives, which is North Italy. It's Friuli. And they have their own dialect.
Cola sera assi pierta li fontanis.
I think it's the song of the bells, and it's all about somebody who's homesick, you know, and hearing the bells and then remembering his village and remembering the frogs, the sound of the frogs and the moon and just the feeling, and he feels he's dead with the sound of the bells, which is one of the lines. And so we just cut it just down to chant, but it's a Friulian word.
How did you learn to sing in this very obscure dialect?
Well, when your pianist understands it, I mean, he just put it on a recording and taped it for me, and I just listened. And I mean, it's strange, really, because the whole thing was put to this tune by Eric Satie, which was La Petite Ouverture à Danser. That was a little piece which Glauco discovered and liked, and we thought we might play it without words, or I might write words to it. And then he suddenly had been reading this poem and discovered that you could make it fit to the tune. So he did that, and then I learnt it and sang it.
You write, also write your own lyrics, as well as interpreting poems, the lyrics of others.
Yeah.
Singing, though, in the words that you would choose, and in what you choose to emphasize. I mean, there are some singers that go for the consonant in the delivery, and there are others that go for the vowel. When you're writing, are you cognizant of that, and do you prefer vowels over consonants?
I suppose I do, because with a vowel, it's more like just the sound of a plain note.
How can we know where to go? It's anyone's guess. Trust less and less what we know.
I do think of the voice as a sound, and I like the sound to be right. You know, when I'm singing a word, I like it to sound right and not to sound alien to the music or as if it's been added on. I like it to come out of the music, and so I suppose, well, we mostly sing vowels anyway. All the sounds of vowels are just open sounds, and consonants are really the rhythmic parts. You can't really do much with them on their own unless you're making a rhythmic pattern, you know.
Mm. You've performed with a trio before, a long time. The trio, when you think about it, you know, the triangle is probably one of the more stable shapes in geometry. However, this new trio, between the time that you recorded some of these tunes on another small label and they got played on the radio, and the time when Manfred Eicher invited you to come into the studio and make the recording for ECM, two of your legs started to argue with one another a little bit, right? The triangle started to fall apart.
Yes, well, I mean, it's like a family, isn't it? You know, you get arguments in families. One is very Italian, that's all I can say, and the other is quite German, you know. So you have sometimes a difference in approach. It was nothing musical, it wasn't a musical argument at all. But when they were having these difficulties, the two of them, I thought, well, I really am desperate to keep this group together. I'm going to see what I can do, and I just rang ECM. And I just said, I think Manfred is interested in this group, I'm not sure, but we want to make another recording, which wasn't exactly true. And I said, if he's interested, could he call me back? And then I thought, well, now I've done everything I can do. I can't do any more. And 2 minutes later, the phone went and it was Manfred saying he wanted to record it. And as soon as I told the two of them that, then they realised this was an opportunity which they could not possibly miss. And there's no problems now between them.
Vocalist Norma Winston. Her album Distances is on the ECM label, and she joined us from the studios of the BBC Radio Kent in Tunbridge Wells, England. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Leanne. It's been a great pleasure.
Hear songs from Norma Winston's new CD and discover a lot more jazz at the music section of our website, npr.org.
Welcome back to All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Andrea Seabrook. Your average runway fashion model these days is close to 6 feet tall, slender, and in her teens. Model Lara Harris fit this description at one point, but by her 30s, Lara Harris thought her modeling career was over. So she left New York for L.A., did a little acting, went back to school, and got a graduate degree in counseling. A new career in psychotherapy beckoned. Now in her 40s, Lara Harris has been lured back into modeling with the promise that the industry has a place for older women these days.
I was doing my graduate work, and I finished my thesis, and I came to New York to play for a weekend. And I saw a former agent of mine who told me there was a lot of work for me.
Were you surprised, given the fact that you're older than your average model these days?
Well, I did know that there was a new market for women. Some people say it's women over the age of 25. Some say it's women over the age of 35. I've heard it's women over the age of 40. But in any of these cases, the shelf life of modeling has been dramatically extended. And I knew that, but I didn't know that I would receive such a warm welcome back.
So can I ask how old you are now?
I think it's important to keep secrets. As an actress, it's a question that's often never answered or is lied about. And then as a model, if the answer gets me the job, I will tell you.
let's back up a little bit. Why do you think that there is this new market for older models?
Well, I think primarily it has to do with women in the workforce, and they have buying power, and they want to see themselves reflected in the ad campaigns, in the catalogs, in the magazines that they read. I can remember when I was 20 years old in New York and doing an advertisement for a Mother's Day ad, and I was the mother. And I can remember doing a recent ad for Mother's Day, and I was the mother. So I think both examples still exist, but today there's more willingness to use a woman who might actually be the age of a mother rather than dressing up and sort of sophisticating an 18-year-old young girl to look like a 35-year-old woman.
Do you approach modeling differently now that you're older?
Yes. well, I have no expectation of myself, and I don't think any of my clients do either, that I would be perfect.
Huh.
And I think when one's younger, there's a feeling that you almost could be, you know, exactly what shows up in the picture. And I think as one gets older, there's just more sense of one's frailty or imperfection or what's not working. And
you still seem pretty sensitive about your age. I mean, you won't tell us how old you are, because you sort of alluded to the fact that it affects your career if people know how old you are.
I don't think it really affects my modeling career as much as it might affect my acting career.
Would you say that the modeling industry based in New York is more open to older faces and women than the movie and television industry based in LA?
Yes, I would. It does seem to me that there is a very refreshing approach to women and aging and what makes a woman attractive here in New York. And in modeling, my agent has talked about how they don't want you to have plastic surgery. They don't want you to do things that are going to make you appear younger than what you are, where, as we know, in Hollywood, that's pretty rampant.
Why don't they want you to do that in modeling?
I think it takes away expression. And I think expression is part of what makes a photograph.
So what do you think the cutoff is now? What do you think is too old for you to model now?
Looking at the industry right now, I'd say 60 to 65, although Carmen, the absolutely flawless older model, I think is around 70. So there really are no limits.
Laura Harris was a model, then studied to be a psychotherapist, and now she's a model again. She joined me from NPR's New York Bureau. Look for Laura Harris on magazine covers soon.